Here's the editor of Lenswork Publishing, Brooks Jensen.
It's been quite a while since I did a list-based podcast, so I hope you don't mind if I'm going to use that format for this episode called 10 Myths That Need Busting. And the idea for this podcast came about because of what I was discussing in a recent Here's a Thought commentary, number 2230, called The PPI Required for Printing. And in that Here's a Thought, I was talking about how the question, how many PPI are required for printing, is an unanswerable question because it depends on another variable that has not been introduced, which is, what is the viewing distance? Because the farther the viewing distance is to the print, the lower the PPI that's absolutely needed for the print to look tack sharp and lovely. So the entire idea that there is an answer to how many PPI are required for printing is very much an inadequate way to think about that question. And that Here's a Thought commentary was all about the logic of rethinking the PPI required for printing. Well, that got me thinking about other myths that need to be questioned and examined more deeply, because there may very well be some missing information or some implications that people haven't necessarily thought about. So how many PPI required for printing is myth number one. Myth number two has to do with accurate colors. I see this all the time, where someone does a YouTube channel or a workshop or a tutorial on how to get accurate colors. And my immediate response to the idea of accurate colors is, compared to what? If I take an image and print it on two different kinds of paper, they'll have a different color rendition. It might be subtle or it might be extreme. And if I compare the two of them side by side, I might see a difference in the way those two prints render color. But if I only see one of them, am I ever going to feel that that color is somehow wrong? Wrong compared to what? Of course, we all know this when we look at an image on our monitor and then print it on paper. They never look exactly the same. Sometimes there's shadow detail that's missing. Sometimes the colors aren't quite right or as intense. But the only reason we know that when we look at the print is because we're comparing it to what we see on our monitor, which, of course, the average viewer is never going to be able to do. They're just going to see the print. But that's not the only way we judge so-called accurate colors. We judge them compared to the real world. But of course, that's not valid either, because at the moment you click the shutter and process the image, the viewer wasn't standing next to you, and they can't see the real world and the real world colors that human vision can render. They're not seeing that. All they're seeing is your print. So the entire idea that the print would have accurate colors compared to the real world, again, is maybe an intellectual discussion, but it's never going to appear as people look at your prints because they won't have anything to compare it to. Which brings us to the human equation in accurate colors, and that is, every one of us see colors a little differently. This becomes really obvious when you consider that there are people who are so-called color blind. They see colors entirely different from the rest of us, but it's more subtle than that. I learned this when we started printing Lenswork, that there was always an individual, one individual in every commercial printing shop who is referred to as having golden eyes. That is to say, they see color more accurately and more vividly than everybody else. And they're usually the people you want to be doing the color checking on your commercial printing project, because their vision is more attuned to color than the average pressman or you or anybody off the street. And of course, as photographers, we're perhaps a little more sensitive to the idea of accurate colors because our world is so vision-oriented compared to the average person walking down the street again. So I would propose that the whole concept of accurate colors is a myth. What we need are colors that are effective, colors that are communicative, colors that are persuasive. But accurate colors, there's no such thing. At least not in a reproductive medium like photography. My third myth that needs busting has to do with the test charts that I see so often on the internet where someone's doing a camera review. and invariably they'll photograph a test chart. And we're supposed to be able to tell something about the camera by the photograph of the test chart. The problem is, I have never, ever seen one of those test charts where they tell us the lens that was used in the test. And even if they did tell us, it would be a little bit of a false equivalency because a Nikon lens might be different from a Canon lens, which might be different from a Micro Four Thirds lens, etc. So what can the test chart tell us? Well, they certainly don't tell us anything about resolution or detail or any of that. They might tell us something about noise levels, but that's become sort of moot now in the age of sophisticated denoise software. So what can a test chart really tell you? Well, maybe it might tell you something about barrel or pincushion distortion, but that's a function of the lens. Maybe a test chart can tell you something about chromatic aberration, but that's a function of the lens. To do a camera comparison by photographing a test chart is just silly. What's far more important is what is the user experience, the ergonomics, the layout and design of the digital menu on the camera. Those things are important. Some of the physical characteristics, like how many programmable buttons. But photographing test charts to compare cameras seems to me to be a total waste of time, unless you're testing lenses. Okay, moving on to myth number 4. There is a very common myth in photography that bigger is better. I wrote an article about this in an early issue of Lenswork, so I know I've talked about this in previous podcasts. But my proposal is that bigger is not better, but better is always better. So then the question becomes, what do you mean by better? I would propose that it's not the size of the image, that is to say, the measured dimensions of a print, but rather the size of the impact and the connection that the image makes with the viewer. That's what really counts. Sometimes that is facilitated by making a physically larger print. Many times it's not. I could cite numerous examples where I've seen an 8x10 print compared to a 3-foot print, and the 8x10 print is better in almost every characteristic, including how it touched me emotionally and from an aesthetic point of view. Chasing bigger is not an answer for making a better photograph, although sometimes it might contribute to what makes a photograph better. But just because you make it bigger doesn't necessarily imply that it is better. Better is always better, but bigger is not always better. As a matter of fact, bigger can sometimes be a detriment to the image because it reveals the flaws in the lens or the grain in the film that you may not want, etc. Certainly an image like the Mona Lisa has made a huge impact on the world throughout history, but it's not a very big painting, certainly not compared to some of the biggest. Same thing could be said with Hokusai's Great Wave off Kanazawa. As a print, the original is roughly 11x14. But what a huge impact it's made in the art world. Bigger is not always better. So if you choose to pursue bigger prints, make sure you're pursuing it for the right reasons. It doesn't necessarily mean that your artwork will be better. Myth number 5. Photographs should not need text. This was drilled into me in my youth. I was told over and over again, any photograph that needs text needs to be a better photograph. But it seems to me that that advice avoids certain realities, not the least of which is we are a verbal species. That's one of the things that makes human beings unique on the planet, is that we can communicate verbally with each other. And in fact, it appears to me from a practical point of view that most photographers understand this. Otherwise, they wouldn't have titles on their work. But you pick up almost any photography book, and there will be titles, and oftentimes titles with every image, but if not with every image, at least there's a title for the book. I've seen lots of images titled Untitled, but I've never seen a book titled Untitled. So words are a part of our world as photographers, whether we like it or not. But I think there's an even more important aspect of words and verbal communication that should not be overlooked. I've talked about this before, about how the viewer of our work is very likely just going through their life, not thinking about you and your artwork whatsoever. but somehow you need to bridge that gap between their mindset and your artwork. And that's probably going to be assisted with words, if not entirely accomplished with words. Words become a bridge between a potential viewer's state of mind and the state of mind required to look at your work with understanding and meaning and wonderment. So the idea that photographs should not need text is entirely mistaken. It's a myth that is perpetuated, I think, by beginning photography teachers, and maybe that's not a bad idea for new students of photography, is to learn how to express themselves non-verbally. But at some point in time, you have to grow past that preliminary beginner's lesson and use words, titles, artist statements, explanations, maybe voiceover. All of those are ways that we can bridge the gap between our work and our viewers' consciousness. And photographers who ignore the idea of text with their photographs are really missing one of the great tools that us visual photographers can employ to make our visual images more impactful. I've never heard of a photography workshop that teaches the integration of text and image, perhaps other than documentary photography or reportage, journalism, that kind of thing. But for fine art photographers, text can be an incredibly powerful tool to make a more meaningful body of work, if we can get past the myth that photographs should not need text. Myth number 6. Small sensor cameras lack a shallow depth of field. I've heard this particularly in the last 20 years, and the race that digital photography put into place about sensors and megapixels and all that. And one of the hits that small sensor cameras often receive is that because they're small, they have a lack of shallow depth of field. And if you really want to have a shallow depth of field, you need a full frame camera. But nobody ever says if you want an even more shallow depth of field, you need a medium format camera, which would be true if depth of field had anything to do with the size of the sensor on your camera. It doesn't. Depth of field is not a physical characteristic, it's an optical characteristic. And there are three things that affect depth of field, and that's the aperture, the focal length, and the distance, not the size of the sensor. Now, of course, if you make a smaller sensor, you need to use a smaller focal length to cover that sensor. So it becomes easy to confuse the two and think that it's the sensor that causes the challenge with depth of field, but it's not. It's the optics that cause the challenge with depth of field. And if you think about depth of field as a function of the three characteristics of optics, aperture, focal length, and distance, you easily see that using a smaller focal length with a smaller sensor is not the only way to create shallow depth of field. And as far as that goes, neither is the aperture and the focal length in combination, because the third element is the most important one, and that's the distance. If you use a long focal length lens and you get very close to the subject, as close as your lens will focus anyway, you can create an incredibly shallow depth of field that is lovely. It has wonderful bokeh. Each lens will have its own characteristics. But the generalized prejudice against smaller sensor cameras because they lack a shallow depth of field is just not founded in any mathematics or logic that have to do with the creation of shallow depth of field as an optical reality. If you want shallow depth of field, you can get a shallow depth of field with any camera you want, as long as you pay attention to the focus distance and use the widest aperture you can get shallow depth of field with any camera you want, including even smaller than Micro Four Thirds, as has been proven, by the way, over the years. Myth number 7, more expensive cameras make better pictures. And of course, that's a myth that's generated from the passion of manufacturers who need, obviously, to sell cameras. But doesn't it make sense that every camera ever used in the history of photography was less expensive than some of today's incredible digital cameras? Today's really high-end cameras cost more than my first car did when I bought it brand new. True, there's been inflation since then, but my point is, more expensive cameras do not make better pictures, and all the pictures from history tell us that's the case. Think of the best pictures in history, whether you think that's Ansel Adams or Bill Brandt or Josef Kadelka or Matthew Brady, it doesn't make any difference. All of their cameras were way less expensive than today's high-end digital cameras. And yet, all of those great pictures from history exist. It's not the expense, nor even the size of the camera, that makes a better picture. We all know that better pictures come from the heart of a photographer matched with their skill in producing them. But getting a more expensive camera is not going to do anything to improve your photographs. It might make your ergonomics more comfortable and your effort easier, but it doesn't guarantee that you'll make better pictures. Saying that better cameras make better pictures would be the equivalent of saying that Rembrandt would have been a better painter if only he had had more expensive brushes, or that Beethoven would have been a better composer if he'd had a more expensive piano. How silly. So the next time you get an attack of gas, known as gear acquisition syndrome, remember that there may be lots of reasons to buy a new camera, but making better pictures is rarely one of them. You may need a feature of a more expensive camera to accomplish the kind of photograph you want, but that's probably a rare, specialized scenario. And as a general statement, we cannot say that more expensive cameras make better pictures. But we can say that a more expensive camera might possibly make the acquisition of a specific kind of image a little easier, but that doesn't make it better. Myth number 8, digital files are better than film, or vice versa. And again, this is a technology component, not an art component, but it seems so silly to me. Would we say that Hemingway is a better author than Dickens because Dickens wrote his novels with a quill pen, whereas Hemingway used a high-technology typewriter? Well, does that mean that Stephen King is better than Ernest Hemingway or Charles Dickens because he's using a computer? Again, the myth that equates technology with quality is what's at question here. Digital is better than film for some things. Film is better than digital for some things. But neither is better when it comes to making artwork that comes from your heart. And the only thing that counts there is the depth of your sensitivity and, to some degree, your skill in implementing your vision. But the tools you use are virtually forgotten. Does anybody remember what camera Edward Weston used? Well, there are some pictures of Edward Weston using a 4x5 press camera, so maybe. But think back about all the photographs that you love, that you've seen in your life. How many of them do you know the camera and or lens that the photographer used? And does it make any difference? Or is that just part of the background? And if asked, perhaps the photographer could tell you, but no one ever asks, because what they're interested in is the image, not the technology. Myth number 9 has to do with the rule of thirds. I cannot tell you how many times I've heard photographers either extol the virtues of the rule of thirds or, more frequently, dispel the myth about the rule of thirds, the idea being that if you follow the rule of thirds, you will end up with better pictures because of the rule of thirds. It's just not true. But that doesn't mean your pictures won't be better. The rule of thirds is not magic, but it's actually good advice, but maybe for different reasons than you might guess. The reason I think the rule of thirds is important and makes sense is because the minute you move the subject out of the bullseye dead center of the photograph and into a position off to the left, off to the right, a little higher than dead center, a little lower, otherwise a position on the rule of thirds, the more you create the necessity to bring in other elements that visually balance the composition. And when you do that, you set up relationships. And you give the viewer's eye a way to travel through the image to see more details, rather than putting the main subject plot in the bullseye dead center. So the rule of thirds isn't magic because of thirds or because of where the intersecting lines are. The rule of thirds is magic because it gets you to think in terms of relationships and compositional flow. That is actually great advice. So in one sense, I think using the rule of thirds is a great idea, but not as a geometric solution, rather as a motivation to create relationships between different elements in the picture. So it's good advice, but maybe for different reasons than you might have guessed. And lastly, myth number 10 has to do with the ways to get better as a photographer. And it seems to me that this is a common pursuit for all of us who are engaged in a creative process like photography, is we want to get better. As time goes on, we want our photographs to get better. It's sort of just assumed that that's part of the creative life, is to learn things and to become more skilled at implementing ideas and images as we have more and more experience. But there's a lot of misunderstanding about this idea of what we need to do to get better. Getting better is not a matter of going to more exotic locations. It might be fun, there might be every reason to do it, but going to an exotic location doesn't necessarily make you a better photographer. It makes you a well-traveled photographer, but that doesn't mean your photographs are any better than they were before you traveled. I could say the same thing about techniques. It's a common myth that if we could just learn how to do something in Photoshop or some yippy-skippy darkroom technique, that our photographs would get better. But it's not true. They might, but learning new techniques does not necessarily mean that your photographs will get better. And that's been proven by an untold number of workshop students who have gone and learned a new technique, but yet it hasn't really changed their photography, hasn't improved their photography. And I would say the same thing about workshops and classes. There's every reason to go to workshops. There's every reason to go to a class. But that's not the best way to make better photographs. And you might say, well, yeah, of course not, because the way to make better photographs is to do more photography. I would propose that even that's shy of the mark. Doing more photography, more captures, more out in the world, filling up your hard drives, will not improve your work. Well, it might, but not necessarily. As a matter of fact, you might just be making the same mistakes and doing the same kind of imagery over and over. The way to get better, from my experience, is to finish more work, not make more pictures, not go out and capture more pictures, not to build a bigger and bigger hard drive of potential images for which you are waiting for the right technique or the workshop or the class. And amassing more and more of those images doesn't improve your work, but finishing always does. Because when you try to finish a project, be that an exhibition or a book or a PDF or a web gallery, when you take a project all the way from the beginning of capturing or editing images all the way through the finished, polished presentation, you will invariably learn things along the way, even if you've been doing photography for 50 years. Every project has something to teach you, but it won't teach you as long as it's a potential project or an idea or something you're stewing on or that is in the state of simmering. No, the way to get better is to finish the work, because that'll force you to make decisions and commitments and see the results of them, and you'll understand your mistakes better, and when it works, you'll actually have accomplished something. I know far too many photographers whose creative life is built around the idea of gathering more assets and having a larger and larger pool of possibilities. Possibilities don't teach. Only finishing teaches. So, that's my 10 myths that need busting. How many PPI are required for printing? This business about accurate colors? The mistake of thinking test charts will tell you something about cameras? The idea that a bigger print is better? That photographs should not need text? That small sensor cameras lack a shallow depth of field? That more expensive cameras make better pictures, that digital is better than film or vice versa, that the rule of thirds is either the devil incarnate or a photographic god, and number 10, the way to get better is to finish more work. And if I had to sum up what I've learned in my 50 years of photography, those 10 myths that have required learning and unlearning would be at the core of my photographic lessons in life.
Copyright 2025, Lenswork Publishing.